broadcast out of New York City. You're listening to Prescriptions for Health on Monday, March 26, 2012. And I'm Dr. Len Saputo.
And I'm registered nurse Vicki Saputo. Thank you for joining us on our weekly Prescriptions for Health show on ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com every Monday live from 1 to 2 p.m. Eastern Time and from 10 a.m. to 11 a.m. Pacific Standard Time. And remember that our shows are archived on DrSaputo.com and PRN.fm.
Today you're going to hear Vicki's 2020 health tips at 20 after the hour and 22 the hour. And we got a great show for you today that's going to include if a baby aspirin can keep cancer away, wouldn't we have something huge?
And is ductal carcinoma in situ, also known as DCIS, cancer or not?
How much trouble is our antibiotic era in?
And the dehumanization of medicine?
And you all know this anyway, but this is probably true. We need to look into loneliness. It can be deadly.
And what's type 3 diabetes? And how does it contribute to cognitive decline in Alzheimer's disease?
Plus, if you want to join in our conversation and have questions about our topics or your health, give us a call at 888-874-4888. That's 888-874-4888.
So, can a baby aspirin a day really keep cancer away? Well, it seems that there are a few or a couple of conflicting studies about this, but usually, you know, we think of aspirin to reduce pain and inflammation and fever and have it be good for coagulation. Particularly, a lot of people like to take it thinking that they're preventing a heart attack and a stroke. So, is it worth it? And what do you think with these conflicting studies? One say it does prevent cancer from spreading 50%, and the other one says, nah, it doesn't.
Well, you know, it's like every other thing in medicine. How do you really get to the real truth? It is so difficult. You see one article that says one thing, and then another one comes out and says another thing, and they all sound exciting, and you don't know what to do.
Well, one of this study that says it works says it takes 10 years to prevent it.
Well, for some, and that's if you use a baby aspirin every day. So the esophageal cancers and colon cancers, I think there's pretty good data that suggests at least that it probably does prevent cancer. And of course, we've got all the other stuff about heart attacks and strokes.
But is it worth the benefit, the risk?
Well, that's a good question.
Especially if you have to take it every day for 10 years.
Well, you know, the part about this that bugs me the most, Vicki, is that we got this darn problem of how do we trust the literature that's out there? And why do we have to just primarily do studies that are on pharmaceutical drugs? Why don't we look at things like fish oil and nattokinase and lumbrokinase and ginkgo biloba and do comparative studies on those with aspirin and Coumadin and Plavix and these new drugs that are out like Pradaxa?
For their anticoagulative benefits.
Why would we stick with using a drug if you're going to be logical about it when you could use something that's safe, that probably works better, and is natural? Why wouldn't we do that? And it's our darn National Institutes of Health that just isn't going to cooperate.
It's so easy. Just take a little baby aspirin. That's not much. What is that going to harm? But it does harm.
Yeah, well, exactly. I mean, that's right. And look at the things that can happen. Things like hemorrhages in your eye, which can lead to blindness, or problems that have to do with other kinds of bleeding in your brain.
I mean, besides your stomach.
Well, yeah, and the GI bleeds and perforations. Those are huge things that have a tremendous mortality, and they're not as uncommon as you might think.
It's like you just take it along and you think, it's all right, it's not bothering me, and probably preventing myself from getting a heart attack or a stroke. And then one day you go to the bathroom and the toilet's filled with blood, or you look in the mirror and your eyes all red.
Well, look at it this way. You have to treat 162 people every day with the baby aspirin for 6 years to prevent one non-fatal heart attack. And you're going to see one non-trivial bleed, like the one I just mentioned, that is going to occur in every 73 people over a six-year period. And then you're not going to really see much in the way of reduction in cancer deaths if this study that was done in Archives of Internal Medicine is correct, where they're saying after studying 100,000 people for 6 years, that there's no benefit in fatal heart attacks, fatal strokes, or an overall cardiovascular death. And then we throw in the cancer part in this, and like you said, Vicki, it doesn't show any reduction in cancer deaths either that's statistically significant. So what are we talking about?
So let's do a healthy lifestyle and take fish oil.
What a concept that would be. Or eat fish. I mean, you don't even have to do fish oil. If we stick close to nature, like Hippocrates suggested about 2,500 years ago, that let food be your medicine and medicine be your food, we wouldn't have all the complications that we're seeing in healthcare today. That would be minimized immensely. So what we're looking at is a business-driven system that's all about return on investment, and it's about making as much money, not caring what happens to people.
Okay, now I have a story I'm going to make up.
Oh, all right.
So let's say somebody has stage 4 cancer.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think you'd be tempted to try the aspirin on them? And I mean, it's certainly not as toxic as chemotherapy.
Well, see, that's a really good question. Look at chemotherapy, and you're talking about devastating effects that don't a lot of the time do much. Well, in stage 4 cancer, you're going to help 2.1 or to 2.3% of people. The other 98% aren't going to benefit from the treatment at all. And the side effects are terrible. Would I try aspirin in that setting? You bet I would. I mean, why not? I mean, if I'd love to see what fish oil does, but we don't have those studies. But we do know that fish oil works very well, probably for chronic myelogenous leukemia. A study came out on that a couple of months ago that showed that that actually cured CML, okay, in people who were in mice that were taking fish oil.
It's hard for people to accept, I think, that something so simple as that would work, you know?
Well, look at Mother Nature. I mean, she is so clever at how she puts everything together. And we've had thousands and thousands of years of experience with Mother Nature so that we've been able to adapt to her. And now we live in a perfect harmony. And then in our infinite wisdom, what do? We get out there and we pollute Mother Nature. We don't listen to the things that are happening.
And everything's about
money.
Nature.
It's about, I mean, we're polluting the planet at the speed of light. We're like a colony of bacteria in a petri dish. They have different phases of growth. One where there's not much, then there's a log phase where you see an incredible increase in the growth of the colony. And then you see what's known as a death phase, where the pollution kills the whole planet.
If you just kind of step back and look down at the whole thing or look back at the whole thing, it's just, we're crazy.
Well, we are crazy.
We polluted our oceans. I mean, tremendously polluted our oceans.
Well, our food,
and our
water, air,
and
soil is now polluted big time. And the sad part about that is we know better. We know we could solve that problem. But we still continue to do the things that we do, saying that it doesn't make any difference. The world is a big place. We can't really pollute it. But we have. When you see the waters of the oceans of the North and South Pole full of PCBs and other kinds of toxins and heavy metals, you know that something terrible has happened. And this is just another probably revolution, a recycling of humanity the way it is. It's a big deal. The lines are open. This is Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Sabuda here with Nurse Vicki. The number is 888-874-4888, and we have a call from Alan in Brooklyn. Hi, Alan.
Hey, Doctor. I took a couple of MRIs of my neck and my brain, and my neck is pretty messed up. And my brain, he said, I have atrophy of the cerebellar vermes to a lesser extent with cerebellar hemispheres. There is mild cortical atrophy involving the partial lobes as well. And he told me to take thiamine, B12, and folic acid. And I asked him why, you know, I asked him what that means, and he says that my brain is shrunk.
Well, you know, you can't just go by that, Alan, but by that alone, Alan, but it's not a great sign. So, I mean, that's something you would want to do as much as you can about. I think a healthy lifestyle is probably the most important thing you can do. And certainly diet is part of it. And getting all the vitamins and minerals and nutrients that you need is a big deal. You may want to check out the studies that were done by the USDA looking at the extensive amount of lack of nutrition that we have in this country. Things like the essential fatty acids, for example, 95% of us are deficient, and you simply cannot have normal tissues or normal brain without that. There are a whole lot of things that you could be thinking about to try and protect the physiology of your brain as well. So you may want to think about providing another source of energy for it by consuming more in the way of saturated fats like what come in high-grade coconut oil to provide ketone bodies, which the brain can use as a alternate source of energy. Then there are things like curcumin that may help slow down the development of Alzheimer's disease.
Well, with the curcumin, I have gallstones, and I read on curcumin that if you have gallstones or gallbladder problems that you shouldn't take curcumin.
Well, you may be right, but you're talking about something that's a lot more important than your gallbladder, and I'll bet that the effect of the curcumin is not striking, but it would be good to look at that in more detail before deciding what to do.
Well, maybe I could take a lower dose of it and see how my body reacts to it.
Yeah, that and ginger, you know, people who are living in India who consume a lot of those herbs have a much lower risk of the kinds of things that lead to mental decline. So there are a lot of things you can do. If you go to my website at drsabuto.com and put in dementia, which you don't have, obviously, at this point, you'll get some tips about what kinds of things you can do nutritionally, as well as what you can do with physical activity and with social interaction. So these are all things that I think you could take a look at, Alan.
Now, also with my neck, he told me if I want to get my back adjusted, I should see a chiropractor, but don't let the chiropractor touch my neck.
Well, that sounds like it doesn't work. I mean, he's telling you to go, but not deal with the part that's the problem. What he's worried about is that some people who have their necks adjusted have a problem with
C4 through C6 and 7 for remanial narrowing, compressing the existing C5 through C7 nerve roots, respectively.
Yeah. Okay, I've got the picture of what you've got. You need to have a very good chiropractor use non-forceful adjustment techniques, which can be done.
You might even want to try an Atlas Orthogonal chiropractor.
Yeah, that's a beautiful thing that could be used.
It's called
Atlas Orthogonal. It's a kind of chiropractic that is very non-invasive. In fact, you cannot feel the adjustments, but you can see on CT scanning the vertebrae moving back into an aligned position. So that would be one thing.
Do you know anyone in the New York area that does that kind of work?
Oh, I think so. No, I don't know anybody specifically.
Do a Google on it.
Yeah, just Google search it, and you'll find people in your area. I'm sure they're there.
Could you spell that out for me?
Yeah, it's Atlas, A-T-L-A-S.
Atlas, yes.
Orthogonal, O-R-T-H-O-G-O-N-A-L. And that should be very helpful. The other thing that could be extremely helpful, and what I use in my office, is infrared light therapy. We use something called a photon stimulator. And that does amazing things for pain, as well as it speeds up healing. It reduces lymphatic congestion. And it really does a lot to make you function a lot better.
I have a couple of other suggestions, too, you could add to your list. Just some craniosacral work, maybe some acupuncture, too.
Yeah, those are all good things to use in combination. It's what we do with the Health Medicine Center here on the other coast.
And there are also chiropractors that use an instrument that's called an activator.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a very gentle way of adjusting the neck, too, if you're afraid of having a major adjustment.
Right.
But they're trained to do it.
I
mean, they're not
much for, I know I've taken up a lot of your time, but I want you to know from the bottom of my heart, I appreciate it very much.
Alan, thanks so much for calling.
You
have a great
better day
and good luck with all this.
Thank you.
Okay, the lines are open. This is Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Sabuto here with Nurse Vicki. The number is 888-874-4888.
Well, while we were on that topic, I thought maybe we should talk about this type 3 diabetes right now and about how that can contribute to cognitive decline in Alzheimer's disease.
Yeah, type 3 diabetes.
Yeah.
We know about type 1. That's the kind that most young kids get when there's a lack of insulin, although there's some new research there that's questioning that. from the point of view that maybe there's something that can be done to get the insulin production back. But type 2 diabetes is quite the reverse in lots of ways, because there what we have is something called insulin resistance. And that insulin resistance leads to the body producing more insulin than it normally would, because it needs it, because the insulin isn't getting the job done that's already there.
So it's sort of like it's dilute.
It's like a diluted insulin, if you will, and probably the defect is at the tissue level, not in the insulin itself. And so although there's discussion about that in lots of interesting ways as well, so it's not a settled issue. But in general, what happens is when you have high levels of insulin, it causes problems with the body converting sugar into fat, with blood pressure rising, with triglycerides rising, and the risk of heart attack and stroke and generalized arteriosclerosis increasing. Now, what about type 3 diabetes? This happens in people who don't have type 2 or type 1. And they may not have problems at all with diabetes because what they've got is a selective insulin resistance in the brain cells. Isn't that wild? So there was this article that came out in the Journal of Clinical Investigation this past month that talks about this. And what they're saying is that insulin resistance in the brain precedes and contributes to cognitive decline. And so there are people who don't have diabetes at all that have this insulin resistance in their brain. And if you have this, your chances of getting Alzheimer's disease or some kind of cognitive decline are up by about 50%.
This article also says the risk of developing Alzheimer's disease is increased by 50% in people with just diabetes.
Well, that's right. So we're looking at a huge thing here. And now, of course, what's the first thing they do? They start talking about, well, you know, there are insulin-sensitizing medicines we can use. Always looking for medicines. And what are they? Well, one of them, metformin, same thing as glucophage, is not a bad idea because the drug works reasonably well, and it may be the only drug that should be used to treat type 2 diabetes, in my opinion, or possibly this type 3. The other two drugs, Avandi and Actos, no thank you. Those are drugs that shouldn't even be on the market, because they cause too many problems. I mean, there's a big hullabaloo about Avandi increasing the risk of heart attack and stroke, the very thing you're trying to protect. And yet, thanks to our wonderful FDA, they're still on the market. And Actos has been linked with bladder cancer and probably with congestive heart failure. I mean, hello, that's not the way to go about it. What if we did something to improve our insulin sensitivity by cutting down our carbohydrate intake?
Instead of trading one disease for another.
Sure. What if we improve our sleep so we don't have so much in the way of high cortisol levels, which lead to insulin resistance? And what about if we exercise regularly so our body learns how to use these products in a way that's really more efficient? These are the kinds of thoughts we should be having, not what drug can we invent that's going to have a jillion side effects like they all do, and probably going to do in the long run more harm than good. The lines are open. This is Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Sabuda here with Nurse Vicki. The number is 888-874-4888, and we'll be back taking your calls after Vicki's first 2020 tip.
The reasons for some of the worst sources of aspartame are that many beverages and foods are contaminated with this neurotoxic posing as a sugar substitute. So I wanted to just talk about some of the top worst sources of aspartame. You know, it's also known as Equal.
Yeah, there's
NutraSweet.
That's right.
But all of them are bad, really. But I just wanted to kind of focus on the aspartame right now, because there are a lot of places where it is that would really surprise you. Like, for example, chewing gum is probably not going to surprise you, and some of the sweeteners on the table in the restaurant. But flavored water products, and then some of these sugar-free foods, a lot of people don't realize, because it says that there's no sugar in it, that it has a sugar substitute in it. A lot of people don't even think of that. And sugar-free beverages and diet sodas and drink flavoring products, those are kind of commonly understood that something like that might be in there. But cooking sauces, children's medicines,
yeah,
yogurt, cereal, it's in a lot of these things. And aspartame destroys female sexual response. It induces male sexual dysfunction. Maybe we ought to give this to all the kids.
We already are, Vicki.
Yeah, right. We already are. You're right. It also disrupts fetal development, though, and many times what happens is a woman will have a miscarriage, or else it contributes to birth defects. And it also can damage the DNA, and what that does is it curses future generations. And then there are a lot of side effects that can happen from consuming aspartame, and some of the most serious, we've just talked about, but aspartame is a lot more harmful than processed sugars even, and high fructose corn syrup. We talk about how those are toxic, but aspartame is worse than that. And some of the amino acids in the aspartame can cause inappropriate release of hormones, and those can destroy regulatory neurons. So we don't want to be messing around with our nerves. And there's just a wealth of independent research that's verified that aspartame is linked to causing autism spectrum disorders and neurological problems, besides the birth defects and GI problems, among many other things.
Well, that's really good information. And we have to keep in mind, why do we need something like that? Look at how brilliant these companies are that produce these toxins are to be able to convince us that we need them. And then we're all out there using it. And it's upsetting a lot of things that are natural homeostasis mechanisms in our body.
And there are other studies that even show that there's a link between aspartame and brain tumors, and that it can promote seizures. It's associated with migraines. And also it's found to cause breast cancer, leukemia, and lymphoma in some of the latest animal experiments.
Well, I just find it incredible that we use things like that at all when you look at the logic of it. And the only reason that it's out there, when you look at it, at the real facts, is because it makes money. And because we are so gullible that we'll, if somebody promotes it or if the FDA approves it, that we think we're just safe. It's the furthest thing from the truth.
Well, just like we were talking about earlier, if you stand back and you look at this planet and what we're doing to it, it's the same thing. It's like, what are we doing to ourselves?
Yeah, well, you have to think, when you put something in a human body, you may not know what effect, if it's not natural, you may not know what it does for 30 or 40 or 60 years. Because when you're putting a new biochemical substance in the human body, you've got thousands and thousands of reactions that are occurring every millisecond in our body. How will that impact us down the road? Unless you do these studies the way we do them, which is after they're brought to market, you have no way of knowing what that answer is. So we bring them out after the drug company has done a few studies relatively. Maybe they looked at a few thousand people or maybe even less. It looks like it does some wonderful things, but we haven't got a bloody clue about what the side effects are going to be down the road.
I know, like the diabetics think, I can eat this piece of candy because
exactly.
It says it's sugar-free.
Exactly. I mean, how stupid can we be?
Well, we've tried to make everything taste better than what Mother Nature has already provided for us, and we keep adding things to sweeten things more, and then pretty soon people are like just craving the sweet taste.
They are addicting. Okay, these are addicting. There are plenty of studies showing that these things are something that we learn to depend on, and if we don't take them in, we don't feel very good. That's the definition of an addiction.
Well, if you want something to be a little bit sweeter, there are other things that you can use that are not bad like that. There's Manuka honey, which has a lot of beneficial effects. It's a little expensive, but it's the best one out there because, honey has its own story about ways that it's processed and so forth. And agave nectar basically is pretty much like eating high fructose corn syrup. I mean, that's been marketed very well, so a lot of people think that that's okay. But I'd suggest it's better to maybe have a little maple syrup if you want to have something sweet, or maybe a little stevia or a little bit of molasses.
Yeah, well, things like that make sense.
A little xylitol. Xylitol is from birch sugar. It has half the glycemic index of sugar.
Yeah, well, listen, we need to get back to staying closer to Mother Nature. When you go onto a diet after you've been on the standard American diet, which is short for SAD, which it is, when you get onto a diet that is using what Mother Nature produces and cook intelligently, the food is way better tasting. And you get to a place where you want to eat that rather than the commercial foods that have all kinds of preservatives and additives and things that are toxic in them that don't do our metabolism any good.
When our granddaughter, before she went to school, and we had her a lot, we didn't give her anything that had sugar in it, you know, or any desserts. We would give her like strawberries and things that were fruit and that were natural. And she was perfectly happy with that.
She loved it.
And when it changed was when she went to school, because all the other kids were eating candy and all these other things that were so unhealthy. And we tried for a while to shelter her from it, but it didn't work too well. But one time I took her to it was a catechism kind of class, faith formation class. Uh-huh. And it was our turn to bring the dessert. And
right.
So I brought big, beautiful, organic strawberries. And there was only one kid in the class, besides her, that would eat the strawberries. And so the kids gave the strawberries to him, and they all said they want, where's the cookies? Where's
the candy?
And so then the teacher had some extra cookies in a drawer in that class.
Oh,
yeah.
That's handy, isn't it?
Yeah. It was kind of sad, you know, to think about it. I've seen mothers in some of the health food stores, well, they'll be giving the fruit to their kids. And I'm thinking that's such a great way to raise them and make them think that that's a big thing. You know, like, oh, boy, you get to have a carrot, or, oh, boy, you get to have a peach.
Well, see, mothers and fathers, people who care about kids, want to make them happy, even if it's at their own health expense down the road. They don't really think about the long-term consequences.
The other night we went to the movies, and there was this kid in line in front of us. He had his hand so full of candy that
it was dropping boxes. Yeah.
Yeah. And his mother had gone over to do something else. So, I mean, she was with him, and they were just buying all these huge containers of candy. Well, when we were kids and we went to the movies and they had candy, they were just little boxes. You know, they were a nickel or something. And now they have these big, huge containers.
Yeah, well, that's true. Oversize Me. Remember the movie Oversize Me?
Yes.
Well, that's the problem. We need to look at the long-term effects on our kids. If you really love them and you're not trying to just make yourself happy because you see your kids happy, you've got to do something to teach them these things.
One time our granddaughter had something that was sweet. I don't remember now what it was, and it was in the car, and all of a sudden she got so hyper. And it was like she was high.
Oh, I remember that.
And you were like, I wouldn't have believed this if I didn't see it.
I know.
Myself.
Well, you see all the literature in the medical world denying, okay, that sweets, high fructose corn syrup.
And the artificial coloring.
Right. Are doing things to make these kids who have ADD really get hyperactive. But when you see it with your own eyes, it's a big awakening. Anyway, the lines are open. This is Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Sabuda here with Nurse Vicki. The number is 888-874-4888, and we'll be back after a short station break taking your questions. Welcome back to Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Lynn Swinner here with Nurse Vicki. Hi, how are you doing? This
very
is
good,
George.
Thank you. How is yourself?
We're doing great, George. What's up?
I was hoping I could discuss with you hepatitis C.
Okay, go for it.
I just like to preface, for 15 years I've been on disability because of a car crash I was in. And in recent years, I've been seeing both of my parents off the planet that were fortunate enough to live to be 90 to be taken out by pharmaceuticals. My father was given Respirol. He lasted 3 days. And my mother, just by a bad turn of events, was given Cipro and had the worst anaphylactic shock that I'm sure you know about, the Steven Johnson syndrome.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah, there are a lot of things with Cipro that are problematic. You're right.
So, needless to say, when I, in this year, turning 65, re-entered into the Western medicine area, much to my struggling with even doing it, I find out that I'm the carrier of hepatitis C.
Uh-huh.
which they assume
do you have any disability from it in any way?
Accident of 15 years ago, or the operation on my crushed knee, or my broken neck issue, or something from somewhere. But this is what I'm looking at the moment. I, needless to say, want to go about as close to Western medicine in this issue as I can stay away from. And I was wondering if you had any insight for me in direction of taking other course of...
Well, first of all, George, are you having any symptoms from your hepatitis C?
I in all assumption, am believing so, yeah.
And what kinds of symptoms do you have?
I'm seeing a doctor about it, but only in the past couple of months. I've only found out about it in the past 3 months, 4 months.
Okay. So what kind of problem are you having with this,
which is your guy that will give me some friendly, pardon me, what's the medicine I'm looking for? Interferon,
yeah.
That I'm sure is the only, and as far as I know, the typical treatment that is about as subtle as a hammer to the head.
Yeah, well,
but,
that's right.
I was hoping that you could have some advice for me.
Okay, let me ask you a question first, George. Is your laboratory liver function tests, do they show any abnormalities?
No, not at the moment. They show a 5 million and change count.
Okay, depending on who you talk to about this, you get different opinions about what the best approach is.
Excuse me.
I kind of hang out with Peter Duesberg, who is really one of the best retrovirologists and best virologists in the world. And his stand on this is that you should not be paying much attention to your titers, okay, that are reflective of your having this this problem. And what I recommend to do, if you have normal laboratory values otherwise and you're feeling relatively well,
is to try
and support liver
function.
I'm weak,
and I've lost a tremendous amount of weight in the past year and a quarter.
Yeah, okay. Well, here are the things I think you should think about, George. You could think about using vitamin C in fairly large doses, and you ought to talk to your healthcare practitioner about how to go about doing that to bowel tolerance.
You're talking about intravenous.
No, not necessarily. It can be done orally to bowel tolerance. Intravenous vitamin C for this is not likely to do a whole lot, but it'll help give some protection.
Then,
of course, you want to make sure you don't have a problem with iron overload problems, because then IV or oral vitamin C is pretty dangerous. And make sure you don't have a G6PD deficiency, because you cannot give IV vitamin C in that setting. It'll cause a hemolytic anemia. The other two things that are good are alpha-lipoic acid and silymarin, which is milk thistle. Those are all good things to help support liver function, as well as taking a diet that's healthy and maybe using general supplements. You may want to check out doing a test that's a little bit complex. It'll tell you more about your nutritional deficiencies. There's a test called an ions test, which will look at things like heavy metal toxicity, mm-hmm. and a whole lot of other things that are related to levels of minerals and vitamins and antioxidants that should be of interest to you. That's about as far as we can go on a program like this to get you started.
Probably no alcohol either, huh?
Oh, definitely.
I've never
no
drank. They say that's to my strict advantage.
To drink?
I've never drank.
Oh, never drank. Yeah, that's correct. Yes.
And no Tylenol either, I would think.
You can't take much of anything because your liver. That's a good point, Vicky.
Don't
realize how toxic Tylenol can be to somebody.
That comment about Tylenol. Tylenol, I was on for a long period of time because I was on
the pain medication.
Oh, there are
Vicodin?
Lots of
No, the up-a-notch.
Or the NSAIDs. There are a lot of those.
Yeah,
but, George, that's about as far as we can take it.
Check.
So I want to thank you for calling and maybe suggest that, because it's time for Vicky's 2022, I want to suggest that what you do is go to drsaputo.com and you can put hepatitis C in the search box and see what comes up. It may give you some clues about what you can do. So
I was hoping you might also have a naturalist or an herbalist or someone in that area that might be able to guide me.
We do have people who are nutritionists that work in that area, but they're here in California and you're there. And it won't be long before we have an online service at drsaputo.com.
Well, a good start would be the alpha lipoic acid and the psilocybin anyway.
Yeah, I think those are ways to go. So that's as far as we can go. And I want to thank you for the call, George. It's time for Vicky's 2020 tip. The lines are open. I'm Dr. Len Saputo with Nurse Vicky. The number is 888-874-4888.
Organic popcorn, yum, yum.
Indeed.
You know, this is actually a whole grain healthy snack. It even has higher antioxidant levels than fruits and vegetables.
That's hard to believe it.
Well,
it?
It's still
something
important.
That tastes
it's still
good.
Yeah, but it's still important to include fruits and vegetables in your diet and to not ruin the nutritional value of your popcorn by making kettle corn out of it with lots of sugar and oil and eating Cracker Jack.
Well, you're right.
Or using toxic oils when you prepare it. Actually, air pop popcorn is the best. And if you want to season it in a healthy way, you can add a little organic olive oil, maybe a little organic butter with that.
It's great. And a little
sea
salt.
That's what we do. And, uh-huh. And coconut oil. You know, if you get a good coconut oil, that's a very healthy thing to put on your popcorn.
I'll say.
And you really, like I said, organic. You really want to have it be organic popcorn because otherwise it's all genetically engineered because that's
exactly
what they do with the processed corn.
That's right.
Yeah.
So, thank you for that. Yeah, popcorn is a great little treat. All that fiber is great, and all those nutrients kind of surprise most people.
I also thought of another thing. You probably don't want to microwave it.
Probably don't
That's
want to microwave
43%
it.
That's got 43% more fat in it compared to the kind that you pop yourself in oil.
Well,
if you don't use,
I
like
don't think
the
you want to microwave
and
anything.
Microwave's bad anyway.
I think that's not a good way to go.
Changes the molecular composition of the foods.
Okay, the lines are open. This is Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Saputo here with Nurse Vicky. The number is 888-874-4888.
So, ductal carcinoma in situ. Let's see now. What is DCIS? You know, the doctors are admitting that they don't know what they're doing when it comes to DCIS.
You know, it's about time.
You know, they're confused about it, and the patients are confused about it. Duh.
Yeah.
No wonder.
I've had many conversations with oncologists and with radiologists about what DCIS is and why we've gone to the extents we have to treat this disease. When you look at a disease that 2% of the time will kill you, and 98% of the time, you'll die with but not from. What are we talking about? Is this cancer or not cancer? And do we need to do the aggressive things to the 98% that involve surgery, radiation, and chemotherapy? Is that really what we need to do? The answer to that is really, this is a silly issue.
Well, what happens is that there's a fear factor involved because the women that have this type of quote-unquote breast cancer are so afraid. And there's been so much talk about breast cancer that the word scares them to death, whether it's DCIS or whatever it is. And rather than to watch and wait, thinking that, you know, only 2% are the ones that are going to have a serious problem from it, that they'd rather just get it off, get it out, get rid of it, and not have to worry about it. But what are they doing to themselves and to their quality of life in the future?
Oh, it's a ton. So if you look at the 98% who don't need it, leave them alone. Just leave them alone. The question is how do you differentiate the 2% from the 98%?
Well, doesn't breast thermography help with that?
Well, it can. Okay, that's really a very good point, Vicky. The mammogram cannot, because all that does is it shows you the anatomy of what these DCISs look like. And they look like little calcifications, little punctate calcifications that are fairly characteristic of DCIS. Then you go in there and you do a surgery to remove it. Then you're followed up with radiation, and then you're followed up with chemotherapy for all of them. Now, a breast thermogram is a different kind of test because it looks at the physiology of what's happening here. And the physiology is characterized by a lot of blood flow to the DCIS tumors if they're aggressive. There is this thing called neoangiogenesis, which means new blood vessel growth. A cancer cannot grow if it doesn't have a blood supply. And they get excessive amounts of blood supply. And what you see are these little entangled blood vessels that carry a lot of blood, which is where the heat of the body is. And that heat then goes to the DCIS if it's a cancer that's a worrisome one, and it lights up and you can see it. But if there isn't a lot of new blood vessel growth, not a lot of this neoangiogenesis, it won't light up. Now, I'm not saying that that's a fail-safe thing to look at, but, you know, this FDA-approved test back in 1982 as an adjunct to mammography has been terribly underused.
So does it light up or not light up with DCIS?
With DCIS, if the DCIS is apt to go on and kill you because it's an aggressive cancer, it will light up. And if it doesn't, it won't.
Oh.
So it gives you more information. And like I said, it's not a 100% test because there aren't any tests in medicine that are 100% anyway. So what we should be doing is adding that to our armamentarium of the assessment. Well, the radiologists are sitting there with their arms folded looking at you like you're stupid.
Because they have to learn something new is what that comes
down to. That's what it boils down to, and they don't have an open mind. You know, back in the 60s and 70s when this thing came into a common use, it was overdone, and we didn't have sophisticated technology. And so there were a lot of false positives and negatives, and the test basically wasn't that good. But we've come a long way. We can measure to a 20th or a 50th of a degree centigrade now. Think of how small that is. And that gives you tremendous information about the heat that's in these tumors and whether or not they're actually cancers. Now, why not add that as another piece of information that can guide you to make an intelligent decision about, do we want to take this out or can we watch and wait?
So I suppose people can do Googles for their particular area.
Well, you can do a Google search. You don't need to do a Google search. Go to drsamuda.com.
No, but I mean if they want to find somebody that does breast thermography in their area.
Yeah, of course. And there are people. This is starting to boom. I mean, go to Gary Null's website. He'll have a list of people there. I'll bet you anything. Mercola has it. And certainly Natural News has it. You know, Mike Adams. These are great resources, and we should be learning to trust them. You've got somebody with the stature of these people who have done a lot of work. That's stuff to look at. So if you can identify that there's heat in a DCIS, you may be a lot more inclined to be aggressive about it. In that case, I would advise my patients, particularly if it's worsening over time, to think about having the nodule removed. I mean, just do that and then watch and wait. And you can follow that up with MRI. See, the MRI is a very good test. It's just expensive. And it's not good as a screening test because it finds too many false positives. But once you identify an area and you look just at that area with your MRI, you get wonderful evaluation of what's going on with that lump and what's around it. And periodically, after you've had a cancer, you deserve to have an MRI on that same breast if it hasn't been removed totally, and on the opposite breast, because we know the incidence of cancer in the opposite breast is substantially high. So this is a test that is time is here. It's been here for 20 years, more than that, for 30 years, approved in 1982.
So instead of keep going back to watch it by having mammograms, which
don't tell you.
Well, and it could make it worse because of the radiation.
Well, that's another good
point. Find somebody that does breast thermography. We do it at the Health Medicine Center in Walnut Creek, California, but other people, like you said, can find out on a Google or else going to these other websites
when you've got
how to find somebody in their area that does it.
When you have 20 to 25% of all cancers being DCIS and the doctors not knowing if it's a real cancer or not a real cancer, and then because they're trying to be on the safe, quote, safe side.
Vigilant.
I mean, they're doing all these things to people. We got a big problem. And it's just about that simple. So we have to change the standard of medicine here. Doctors have to admit they don't know which DCIS is to treat and which not to. I mean, the only people that got to be really excited about this and think it's a wonderful deal would be two groups. One would be Big Pharma, because now instead of treating 2% with their expensive chemotherapies, they get to treat 100% if the patient will go along with it. And then people like the American Cancer Society, who are still promoting that the mammogram is the cat's meow, especially for women under the age of 50. And, of course, they have ties that are incestuous, huge conflicts of interest with Big Pharma, who funds the bulk of what they get. So we've got a long way to go here in questioning the medical profession. What are you doing and why? And is there a better way to do it? And the answer is obviously there is, but we got to take our head out of the sand and start looking at what's been around for 30 years that we're not utilizing properly. The lines are open. This is Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Saputo here with Nurse Vicki. The number is 888-874-4888.
Well, our antibiotic era is ending, according to the World Health Organization. This is another instance of what we're doing to ourselves, all the problems that we're creating. You know, antibiotics have saved lives for like over 50 years.
Yeah, try 60. That's right.
And effectiveness is less now because they've been being overused. And so what happens is we develop a resistance. And some of the big bacteria that we develop resistance to that can kill us are like the MRSA, the methicillin-resistant Staph aureus, and the C. difficile and E. coli and so forth. But this has become like a global crisis. We're going to end up with not even being able to use antibiotics and have diseases that can't be treated. I mean, what if a kid falls and scrapes his knee and gets an infection?
Gets a MRSA, yeah, and dies from that. Well, this is a big deal. We're looking at 100,000 deaths now every year from what we call nosocomial infections, which means hospital-acquired infections. And now these MRSAs and C. diffs and E. coli that are resistant to everything are in the general community, and we're seeing these infections there too.
People need to stop asking their doctors for antibiotics.
Well, doctors have to use better judgment. I wouldn't put it on the patients. I would put it on the doctors. Because if the doctor is the one writing the prescription, I mean, you can say something called no. This is a dumb idea. Don't do it. I do it all the time.
A lot of them are in a hurry, and they just do what the patient wants. Why do you think direct-to-consumer ads work? It's because they work.
Well, it doesn't work in my office. Somebody comes in, and they want an antibiotic, and I think it's a bad idea. I won't give it to them. I'll say, go to somebody else if that's what you want to do, because it's a wrong thing to do.
Well, the other thing, too, is a lot of these antimicrobial hand sanitizers and things that they're putting in so many different products now are contributing to this epidemic also.
Where we're doing all kinds of things to try and kill the microbes, and what we've forgotten is what Beauchamp said about a couple hundred years ago when he argued with Pasteur, who is the guy that invented who discovered the germ. And Pasteur was saying, it's the germs that are invading the tissues. And when that happens, we get sick. And that's the problem. It's because the bug is so pathogenic. And Beauchamp said, no, it's not just that. It's the person's defenses, their immune system. It's their ability to fight off these bugs. It's the big issue. And, of course, both of them are right. But Beauchamp is the one that has the real answer by saying, live a healthy lifestyle. Do the things that you can do to take care of yourself. Build your immune system. And then when these bugs come along, they're not going to do the things that they do to you.
Yeah, because see, what's going to happen is there are times that we really do need to have antibiotics.
They save a lot of lives, but they're starting to cost a lot of lives.
So what do we do when somebody gets an infection and they can't use an antibiotic, you know, like people that have chemotherapy, for example? Immunity goes way down.
Yeah,
about it. When somebody's going to have a bone marrow transplant, they have to put them in reverse isolation to protect them from any kind of germs at all.
Sure.
And if an antibiotic didn't work, that would probably be the end of them. And then with surgery, a lot of people need antibiotics with surgery or after surgery or when they have transplants and some of the premature babies that might end up with an infection or so forth, or even something as simple as strep throat.
Well, these are a big deal, but there are things that we can do that are really useful.
I mean, maybe we should be using those now instead of waiting till we can't use the antibiotics.
Well, I think that's right. I mean, you look at things like photooxidation and people are going, photo what? And this is something that was done in the 1940s before the antibiotic era had developed. And what they did is they took about 200 cc's of blood out, ran it through a coil through ultraviolet light, and put it back into the body. And that did unbelievable things to people who had sepsis okay, from intra-abdominal infections like perforated bowels or gallbladders that were infected and ruptured, and the appendix if it was infected and ruptured. And basically, if you were moribund and expected to die imminently, about half of those people survived.
And then what about things like IV vitamin C, too?
IV vitamin C for viral infections particularly is a good thing. And then you're looking at things like probiotics and nutrition and building your immunity like we were talking about.
What about the Rife machine?
Well, that's a good question. You know, the original Rife machine was built to cause to give people a radiation of a certain frequency of light that would be just the one that would kill certain microbes. And each microbe has a different frequency of light. Each cancer cell has a different frequency of light that will cause it to self-destruct. It just explodes them. The original Rife machine apparently did that. But when you're looking at the machines now, okay, that are out there, I have lots of doubts about it. I think there's work that needs to be done in that field. And, of course, the FDA, the CDC, the World Health Organization will do anything to stop you. If you come out with information that says you're using a Rife machine, your chances of being shut down by the FDA are pretty good.
They'd probably rather have you take an antibiotic.
Well, they'd rather have you do anything.
But what about the photon stimulator? You said light.
Well, it may be something that could be useful, but I think that's something that has to be looked into as far as a research technology. So we're at the end of the show, and I'd like to remind you, we'll be back live to talk about what's new in the news and health and take your health questions every Monday afternoon on PRN.FM and DrSaputo.com from 1 to 2 Eastern Time and 10 to 11 Pacific Time. Prescriptions for Health will also be archived in DrSaputo.com as well as PRN.FM.
And if you've enjoyed today's show and you'd like to have more information on the topics that we discussed, you can go to DrSaputo.com and check out our Fast Track videos. And remember, lifestyle is the most powerful healer in the universe, so if you want to be well, pay attention to the style in which you live your life.
Have a great week. It's been good being with you.